Hello, welcome to Browser's Bookshop. I'm Catherine Lana, and it's my pleasure this evening to welcome Julia Blackburn here with us to talk about her new book. I'm sure you're all very familiar with Julia's writing. It's won loads of awards, great acclaim, and great affection from her readers too. And I suppose the last book was that made her name, if you like, with us, was Threads, about John Craske, the fisherman, which was just amazing. And I'm sure you'll feel the same about this book too. It's called Time Song, In Search of Doggerland. And I'm going to be talking with Julia for about 40 to 45 minutes, and then there'll be the opportunity for your questions too. I'm sure you'll have lots to ask. And then, of course, you can have your book signed. If I'm not speaking too closely into the microphone, if you'd like your book signed. Okay, so let's start. So, Doggerland, can you tell us a little bit about how this book came about? What was your quest to find out about Doggerland?
Yes, is my voice doing the thing it's supposed to be doing? Yes, it is, all right. My quest for Doggerland, well, I think that it started when I was... I think it starts because I'm short-sighted. That's probably the beginning, in the sense that as a child, you know, they'd say, look at the view, look at the thing, and I was always busy like this, looking down, and that my idea of a day well spent on a holiday was to sit by a rock pool and just look at small things. And all through my life, from that time, still even with contact lenses, still having that kind of short-sighted mentality, I've always collected objects that hold a story. So whether it's something that's been given to me that then is you know, that has a meaning that way, but a lot of it is a little stone or a fossil or a something, a piece of glass, that when I look at it, I see the story that it tells. And with that, I've had a sort of compulsion. I live by the sea or near the sea in Suffolk, and if I go to the sea, also if I walk across a ploughed field, I'm always with my, I see it in photographs, I have my head bent down like that, and it gets more as time goes on, looking for objects on the ground and picking them up. And for all the years before doing this book, I was aware, I did find a bit of mammoth backbone, and knew that it was a mammoth backbone, that was about 24 years ago, and thought this is wonderful, and I did find a worked flint at Dunwich, beautiful worked flint. But I hadn't got the kind of concentration that this book gave me, and I had a lot of pebbles that had like little kind of hieroglyphs, which I would try and read and see what they were saying. But then I went to a talk in Halesworth, at the art centre in Halesworth at the Cup, in 2014, end of, I think it was, about Doggerland. And I had known of it a tiny bit, but I didn't know a lot. And it hit some kind of nerve in me, this idea of there being a country that, it's a sort of philosophic idea, that there's a country that is there, that was there, but it's covered by water, and that it holds its history within its own depths somehow. And that because of recent technology, rather ironically, the quest for North Sea gas means that the money that archaeologists can never put into things is suddenly available to do these core samples and to do seabed studies. And so all the archaeologists and the paleontologists had moved in and had started using that and building it up towards a map of what Doggerland once was. But to go back a bit further, which was also explained to me then, is that it used to be thought that we all know of Dogger Bank, of that's the sort of shallow land. It was an island of some sort, but it used to be thought that it was just seen as a tiny little kind of bridge over. And the big change came with the change of trawling. Because of doing a different kind of trawling in the nets from the beginning of the 20th century, where the nets brought up lots more from the bottom. And I had one of the wonderful visits I had on doing this book was to go and see a Dutch fisherman called Klaas Post, who lived, his family was at what was an island in Holland called Urk. And on the island of Urk, which is now brought onto the mainland, it was very strict Dutch reform religious community. Very kind of, you know, everything was in the Bible, and if it wasn't, it was dangerous. The fishermen with this new trawling method went out, and every time they whopped their nets in, they'd come up with a mammoth tusk or a bit of rhinoceros or, you know, things like this. And they would, he told me that his grandparents' generation, they thought it was stuff of the devil and they would smash it. But his grandfather was liberated and more free-thinking, so he dried his nets on the horn of a giant deer, which would be something of a kind of 4-metre span. I mean, it's a serious deer. So I heard about it at that talk at the Cup, at the Full Circle, and I thought, well, I'm going to try and see if I can write about it, because it hit something. And so I had about a year of thinking I must be going mad, because I had to learn things that I knew nothing about. But bit by bit, piecing it together, and I suppose rather like what I learned with John Crass, that as long as you keep on connecting in with people, people who know, people who can talk to you, people who can explain, it means that I can't do the big academic studies, but I can meet a paleontologist, or I can meet, as I did in the early parts of this book, very, very curious sort of cross-section of society of people who look for stuff. And many of them, there was one who retired, or he was retired very young, a man who was in the bank, who lived near the Ponting's holiday camp up the road from me. He got some degenerative bone trouble, and he was told the best thing to do was to walk on the sand. So he, with a friend of his who was autistic and another friend who had something else to say of him, you can imagine this kind of team, Marx Brothers team. He had an obsession of thinking that if he looked long enough, he knew that there was a riverbed from long, long ago. If he looked long enough, he thought he'd find something. So the autistic one, Paul, he said, oh, we just always drank gin and blackcurrant juice. And he'd go out into the sea, and they sieved the sea at the place where Bob Much thought that he would find it. And finally, by some extraordinary coincidence of circumstance, he found evidence that human beings had been there 200,000 years earlier than anybody had ever thought. He found the flints and the core, the bald core. So it was meeting people like this Robert Much in his house near the Pontins holiday camp, with a lop-eared rabbit in the front porch as you came in, that kind of locked about, 3 ferrets in the kitchen, a lurcher sleeping next to the television, and an enormous quantity of fossils that he found, which he sort of said, oh, look at this. And then his funny kind of philosophic thing, that this study, this walking, had kept him going, even though sometimes he could hardly walk, and had been a sort of point of concentration for him. And what was so wonderful, which sort of started off for me the possibility of doing this book, he said that when he found these plinths, they're only little because it was small pebbles and it was early people, 800,000, 750,000 years ago, I'm very bad at numbers, who had obviously just stopped, knacked a few little flints to make a sharp scraping thing, caught some animal, I mean caught the animal, knacked the flints, settled down, dealt with the animal, eaten it, bit of fire, moved on. But in describing it, you could see that as he spoke of it, he could see it happening. And he said that that was the honour for him, was to come across this and to have this tiny window open into an ancient, ancient past. Mm. And once he'd found it, he then contacted the Natural History Museum, and they came with all their kind of big men, some big women, lots of big men, and sort of swept the whole thing away. And he and the blackcurrant and brandy drinker, and the other one was sort of, you know, slightly put to one side, very much put to one side, and it changed the nature of the history of human habitation. So that's how I started, and then for about a year I stumbled along, mostly meeting people, and then got enough courage to be able to meet a paleontologist. And all of the different chapters were based on going to places and seeing it, because if you're told there are fossilised footprints on the Severn estuary, and they're formed like this, it's very different to if you go there and get covered in mud and follow this paleontologist who's been doing it for 40 years. And he says, ah, there you are, look, there's the footstep of a crane that trod on the mud 8,400 years ago, and you see it now. Or here, the bit that really touched me with that particular expedition was the fossilised rainfall from 8,000 years ago. little pop marks on the mud that then through a process of lamination is preserved. So I was trying to put words to these kind of things.
Wow.
Sorry, the first time I've spoken about this book here, so I've done a little bit of radio stuff, but it's the first time I'm trying to explain it, and each time I think, oh, I hope it's stupid. But that's a good start. I think it's going.
But it is such a massive subject, and yes. The numbers are so great. Mm-hmm. So how did you, I mean, you were inspired and you're enthused by that talk, and then literally what did happen next? How did you embark on the project of finding out more? Who was the first person that you spoke to, and how did it lead on?
The first thing I did was go to the Pontins holiday camp.
Right, yes.
Down to the sea there, and it was like, it was an absolutely, it's an extraordinary place. And so I went there and saw nothing, but had a sense of that this was where the plinths that Bob Mutchford found were there. And I asked the lady in the bar or the information centre, I said, did she know anything about Doggerland and whatever? And she said, no, you learn something every day, don't you? And she had this wonderful tattoo that said, faith, hope and pixie dust. And then somebody else said, no, I don't know about Doggerland, but there are things from the First World War somewhere near here. So it was that whole time confusion of when you go back, people get to... So that was the first. The next one was Ray, who was the... I was walking along and met this old man with a plastic bag, and I walking along, face towards me, on this very remote bit of wall, relatively remote back over. And I said, have you got any treasure? And he said, I got lead, get 10 quid a week for it, or something like that. But I said, do you ever find bones? And he then had this wonderful thing, I said, I got hundreds of them at my garage, come and have a look. So I made an appointment to go and see Ray, and that was, there was something with that, and he gave me lots of things. He said, I've got a box of mammoth bones, if you have got a use for them, and this and that. And he built up, I sat with him and his wife drinking tea, and he kept on going off to the garage and coming back. And he said that for him, finding was the thing. He didn't bother about keeping things much, but finding. And again, there was this intimacy with the distant past. There was something so wonderful about him talking about it. He said things like he'd been there after a storm, and there'd been an outline of a vast beast it's revealed in the cliff. And he had no doubt idea what it was, and as he watched it went. And there's something that's possible. And that bit on the part of the Suffolk coast there anyway, particularly now it's been returned to the friendly environment, the government not doing anything to protect it at all. But it's great chunks break away, and that whole bit from where I am up to Lowestoft was an old riverbed. It was the old Unio riverbed. So it is where for the last 900,000 years, things have fallen into the river, and people have been and gone, and things have been and gone, and they're within that mud or within the lowest strata, which is, you can look at this little bit of cliff, not much higher than you know, the fiction section there. And you know, at the bottom it's 2 million years, and at the top it's 250,000 years. And it's something to me who's interested always in time. I've never been able to see it so visually as I have with doing this book.
So you met enthusiasts originally, initially, and then you felt brave enough to talk to the professionals.
Yes.
But as a writer, was your instinct to read a book about the whole thing?
I did read books, some of them, but then I found very much that, which I think I'd learnt from doing the Threads book, is that it amazes me how people like to talk about what they know about. And so that I would read a book by somebody like the one who'd written a book about the fossilised footprints, and I thought, oh, blow me down, I don't know if I'm understanding this. Then I met him in Waterstones, in fact, in Piccadilly. And he said, come on, I'll take you on the Severn Estuary. And with that, then the whole thing changes. So that I did read a lot of stuff. And the very technical stuff which I wanted to put into the book, I then made into songs, because you read these very, very, you know, things about the passing of hundreds of thousands of years, this sort of thing. And how do you deal with that information? How do you, if you're like me, it's the numbers all going to a kind of whiz. And the actual information, when it's in paragraphs, is too complicated. So when I wanted a kind of informative step, I would make them these little songs. Which could do dates and things like that. And otherwise, there's a lot of meditation, but it's a lot just to do with talking to people and meeting people and seeing particular things that I read about, like Tollemann in Denmark, who I always thought about this mummified face, body of somebody who died in a bog 2,400 years ago and has a face of such exquisite beauty that you sit and look at him in a museum and you think if you just wait another minute he's going to open his eyes and say, ah, such a strange dream I've been having. You know, it's those kind of things. And I think the thing that was the real revelation for me in doing the book, to do with loss, to do with death, with loss, these kind of things, that I'd always thought that you had to see infinity forwards into the future. And with doing this book, I realised, for me, maybe for other people, infinity goes backwards. That's where the real time lies. That's where the miracle of it lies, if you like. The enormous sweep that's come before this fraction that we're in. And with that, I got a kind of... comfort is too vague a word, but it was something then that made me much more comfortable within this fragment of time that I'm in now.
There's certainly a sense of hope from the book, is that we've survived so much.
Absurd, yes.
But let's talk a little bit about the structure of the book then, because you mentioned a little bit about the songs. Can you just take us through how you've decided to divide up the book and all the different components that there are in it? Because you've got the songs, you've got the art, you've got your meeting people.
There's little personal bits as well. It was very organic. I think that I started with a very technical, trying to do just the meetings with people. And then every so often I think, enough, and then add a different layer to it, I think. So I first of all did the text, and then I got stuck with this information that I needed, so I did the songs. And having done the songs, I wanted to do something where I could see why it was that I was doing this kind of study. So there's a little piece about collecting bones and stones as a child, or there's a bit about the funny perseverance of doing it, which I have, and learning paleontology hand to mouth, as it were. And I then thought of a scene when I was in my very early 20s, and I took a commission. I was living in a clapped out little cottage in Wales without electricity, and somebody said, would I write a book on how to be a conjurer? And said that he'd spent the advance, but if I wrote it, I could get the second stage of the advance. Which I could have known is not a good idea. But I did the damn thing. And it was for an American publisher, and phoned them up from the phone box, and they said, you must be joking, we can't publish this, it's ridiculous. But in the process of struggling for 4 months to understand how to do sleight of hand and how to do all these things, typing it out on an Olivetti, I'd enjoyed the process of learning. So that in doing a little piece about that made me understand what the earth I was doing, busy in the AOC or the Holocene, you know, trying to bring life to these things. And it is amazing if you get... I think I found that with biography, that somebody, when I was writing a book about the painter Goya, and it was actually Bernard Cornwell, the writer Bernard Cornwell, who my father had taught when he was called Bernard Wiggins. And I knew as a kid because of that. And I said, I want to write about the Peninsular War. And he said, always go to the small details. Never try and get the big books. Always get to the little details of the foot soldier or the something, the letter home. And it's the same with this book. If you get the small details of things, their hearts and heads will follow, whatever it was that Bush said. You know, but that you can then, you can, that's where you get this, like a little tiny advert in a newspaper from the Victorian age will tell you more about the society than some great tome of saying, you know, the consumerism in the Victorian age. It's something there. So it was that was the secret of it, I think.
Well, They make it so vivid for us as well. It's a way in, and particularly with a subject like this, which is, as I've mentioned, is so unwieldy with the numbers.
Yes.
But the songs, how did those come about? Because you weren't you listing the information in it?
Yes.
So how did they evolve into the...
I made it started because I wanted to explain. I had the first song came where I've done songs. I did these poems called Murmurations of Love, Grief, and Starlings, which was which I found it better to put the first time I've written poems. I used to do nonsense songs when I was little, but younger, but not little, but younger. But that there's a kind of thinking where you narrow things down into short sentences, which is an interesting way of looking at your own thoughts. So that was a poem about grief, about loss of my husband. And I would write it in the middle of the night, the kind of first drafts, but in these short pieces, which helped to clarify the thoughts. And with the time song, I was starting to think, I am this age, and my grandparents were born in the 1880s. That sort of stepping back that one has of where one fits oneself in time. Grandchildren who are on the edge, and if all goes well, I'll be dead by the time they, you know, that kind of thing. And then suddenly doing the next leap back and saying the world was born, I forget now, 56 million years ago or something like that, or 560, as I say, I'm not good at numbers. And I made it as a list because I wanted to get a perspective of how long ago and what when things shifted. But then I wanted it to be known within the book, so the list became a poem, a little kind of time song. And it seemed that then I could look at it, even if I didn't use it in the book later, I could then look at it and see these different chunks. And it's quite, I could do a little bit of it to give you an idea. It was a great revelation. It was wonderful to do. And I think, they were. So it starts, I'm 67, already quite a long while to be here in the world. My husband who died was 11 years older than me. War spreading across Europe. And as a child, he saw people assembled in the square near where he lived, his best friend taken away, never to return. Then it goes to my grandmother, my grandchildren. And then it goes, according to a little book I've owned for ages, the Earth was born 4,500 million years ago at the start of the Cryptozoic Aeon. Right through to the first people, during the last 2 million years of the Pleistocene, which has been and gone, and the Holocene, where we more or less still are, humans took shape. Homo ergaster, erectus, heidelbergensis, and sapiens, which is us, all balancing that big skull, eyes set forward, dexterous fingers good at holding tight and making things. So with that, I felt that because I was in such a huge territory, I felt that centered me, that gave me a compass. Mm. And every time I got stuck, I turned into a tiny thing.
So they punctuate the book.
They punctuate it, yes.
But there are also some artwork that's in there as well. So yes. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
This is that when I was 16, about to be 17, I was in Spain with a rather drunken friend of my mother's who was driving us, me and his girlfriend. And anyway, she said, oh, I know a painter. And we went to see a Spanish painter called Enrique Brinkman. And he was 10 years older than me, and I fell in love with him, as one does, but spoke no Spanish, and he spoke no English. And it's a very curious story, because he was a very dedicated painter already then, and I would love just, and I stayed there for about 4 weeks or something, and went back to finish my A-levels, after a dilemma as to whether to go back. But I would sit and watch him paint, and I'd been brought up in such a wordy household. And I loved the fact that we couldn't communicate except in the tiniest way, but I could watch the process of his painting. And over the next 54 years now, we wrote letters. I had a little Collins German dictionary. He never learned English, damn it. And I would make up letters, which he said were sort of medieval, and he would write back in Spanish with drawings. And sometimes I would send a shell or something. And this has been a communication that's gone on all this time, and every so often we've met. And now that I speak Italian, he speaks Italian, so he can actually speak better now. But it seemed to me that he would, I asked him if he would do some drawings for me, without saying quite what. And he said, well, that's a very nice coincidence, because I'm doing paintings about the Cambric, what's it called, Cambrian. See, he does these very abstract, but very lovely paintings, and he was doing a series of that. So he went off for a week to the coast of the dead, in Spain, and then sent me this folder of drawings, which fitted, I thought. And it's part of the same thing. It's these little tiny images that connect, and to do with communicating without words, I suppose, which he and I have done all that time. But then communicating with image, which is what happens when you go to prehistory. You communicate with image and not with words.
What about the cover image? What does that signify? What are they?
The cover is a couple called I forget their names, the something of a couple from Holland, who are on tour. So I went to see them at the Weerdigen couple. They're from the same age as Tolleman. But they were found in 1904 in a bog in Holland, flat. And as always, people thought, oh, what is this? What's going on? And then the vicar was brought, and the policeman. And the policeman rolled them up like a carpet. Here to town and unrolled them, and they've been unrolled ever since. But they're and if you have it as a proper photograph, they're rather grisly because they're brownish and odd. But in a silhouette, I thought in a silhouette they looked like two people, rather sort of Shakespearean. And I think of this as his thoughts walking through time. So that was that, and it just seemed like it was such a lovely image, and the conviviality. Awesome. It's so nice.
But can we talk a little bit about the personal side of the book as well? The memories, if you like, of your husband and the relationship that there was there between England and Holland, and how that has fed into the book.
Yes, well, that I suppose is that for a long time, my husband, who died 5 years ago now, I'd known first when I was 18. And I was in England, and he'd come over to England, but he had all his connections in Amsterdam. So we started this zigzag back and forth across the site. And then at various times we then lived together in Holland for about a year. And I learned rudiments, very simple rudiments of Dutch then. And then we parted, and I met another Dutchman and married him and had two children by him. So I was again doing this zigzag back and forth and learned proper Dutch. And then re-met my first dove, Herman, and married him in 1999, and I was again doing that zigzag, particularly at the beginning, the first year he was teaching in an art school in Amsterdam. And so that I got used to having this sense that the North Sea was a minor division. It was just, you stepped over, just like that, and sometimes because it's so muddy looking anyway, and with my first husband, then his family had a house right on the sea on the other side, so whichever side you were on, you could see the other side in your mind as well as in the you can't see it, but you can, if you look long enough at the horizon, you feel that you see the land. So that was that. And then the funny coincidence of various bits when I was first with Herman, my second husband, that we had a year when he was in Holland and I was in England, and we were meeting every 2 weeks or so, but faxing. And some of the faxes that he sent, there was one that has this little drawing where he said, showing that we were parted with England, drawing of England and then Holland, and then this kind of circle, boom, 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 like that, with spikes, you know, darts coming out of it, because that was what separated us. And then when I started this book, which I started 2 years, I suppose, after, maybe only a year after his death, that seemed to me suddenly like a map of Doggerland. It was a very odd thing. And then he also, in one of these faxes, he said, do you realise that from now on, even if we're apart, we'll always be together? And that again was the underlying thought of this book, that the whole past, even though you're separated from the past, you're separated from people you've loved, there is an element that always stays there. And so that the book, in a way, it's to try and get closer to that thought, and that in the earliest, simplest way, you take a bone of a mammoth and you hold it and you see something of a mammoth, but you also take the idea of somebody you've loved who is not there and yet they are there, and that then is a follow-up of the same thinking. Mm. Are you with me?
I am. I'm just wondering what to ask you next. How do you hope that people will respond to this book then, and particularly people in East Anglia, people in Suffolk? Would you like us all to be walking along the beach as you do, looking at the fossils, looking at bits of the past, or how would you like us to respond to this book?
Gosh, I think the particular, I don't know if that's not relating to East Anglia particularly, but I think this thought of the past being an infinity that we can relate to, that's one of the things. And the fact that deep time, that the enormity of time is literally beneath our feet, or if you go to Covehithe, it's sort of, you know, you have one big storm and you see, you know, and I've had it of going to Covehithe after a storm and pulling something out and thinking, blow me down, it's a bit of whale skull from, well, that must be about a million, you know, that sort of thing. And it's so vivid that that's then something, it's not to say necessarily you need to go after a storm to Covehithe and look for whale skulls, but it's something which has a, which is a quality here, which is very special, because it's such a kind of vulnerable edge of coastline, and it's a very, it was Doggerland in its heyday of the Holocene time and before, but in this recent time from when it first emerged 11,500 years ago until it finally submerged this time, which was 7,000 years ago, it was 6,500, it was as big as France, and it was meant to be the most densely populated area in the whole of Europe, because it was so conducive to life. It was an area of marsh and river and estuary and lake, so that all the evidence is that it was the most crowded area. It was also in a previous time thicker with mammoth than anywhere apart from Siberia. You know, so that it's to see that this invisible energy of what was there is very, I find, exciting. And it is absurd to walk along a beach and pick up a hand axe or pick up a bit of mammoth. I bought a bit of mammoth with me.
Cool.
And it's been receiving, the book has been receiving great reviews so far. So how do you feel about that? Do you seek them out? Do they get sent to you?
They get sent to me. And my editor says, there was one in The Observer which was saying that she didn't like it so much because it wasn't Threads. And he said, very odd review. And he said, read it, but don't worry. You know, that kind of thing. But it's nice, but bad reviews are not nice. Good reviews are nice. And then you then forget, you know, it's the book is sort of done.
Yes.
But it's nice. I did like the reaction to Threads very much because I felt that it made a different connection between me and a reading public, which I found very interesting, that people, it had a kind of nice wide communication. So ideally, in this other one, it's slightly more esoteric, but I think that I'd hope that people would enjoy reading about the time song.
Okay, well, readers, what would you like to ask Julia? The opportunity now just to chat with Julia and ask her what you'd like to know about Doggerland. Yes.
Could you paint for us a picture of what this very densely populated...
Yeah.
I mean, was it heavily forested? Had it all been cleared of agriculture? What
have we got?
Oh,
we've got no agriculture. We
no agriculture,
no
hunter-gatherers.
This is all hunter-gatherers. The whole middle bit of the book is trying to understand the mentality, the what it is to be a hunter-gatherer, and that was everything until the Mesopotamia, till the Fertile Crescent, which is only a mere 8,000 years ago, isn't it?
Agriculture started 10,000
years. But it's spread across by 8,000 years. So that it's groups of small groups of people. It's everything following everything else. So that there's a nice process that the ice melts. 20,000 years ago is the end of the last great ice age. But then it takes 3,000. I'm going to get the muddle with this, but it's the first 3,000 years. Then it's just settling. So you have birds coming in and dropping stuff, and the sediment builds up. And then you get the first lot of vegetation. And then once you've got the first grassy vegetation, which is the first stage of it, then the first animals move across from the south, so that you have the movement of horse and elk is coming, but then goes off quite quickly further north. And then the people follow the animals that come in, get bear and wolf and all the rest. It's a very nice sort of process. Then that goes on until 12,500 years ago, and then there's what we might have now. There's, because of all the shifting of the ice, it makes an enormous woof, that there's a volcano that goes off. There's a slide. It suddenly goes very, very cold for a mere 1,500 years, and then once again it sort of, so everything is wiped out again. The trees that have started are wiped out. And then again, it starts up slowly. And then from that time, from 11,500 to 7,000, then it's just a build-up. Because you've got these muddy salt plains, you know, mud flats and whatever, estuaries, you've got the fish, you've got the beavers, you've got the birds, and the birds bring the animals bring the, you know. And then it's just, it seems as if it, it was a very, very, from the quantity of material that they find, this very densely populated area. And then it all goes on, but the water goes on rising, so that every 100 years it's going up 2 metres at some point. So it's a huge thing on a flat land. And then because of the shift of all the ice melting, then there's the thing called the Storaga Slide, which is a great, huge, great stretch of underwater bank between Norway and Iceland, I think it is, that drops, that falls down. And there's also a volcano. So then then there's this trouble at Mill. But some people seem to have gone on for another, particularly on Dogger Island and other people. But a lot of people had to start escaping or they'd get stranded on islands. And there you go. But it's so interesting when you speed up, you know, because we think it sounds fast, and yet we've only been around for such a short time that it's not that fast. And that I did go in Denmark to see somebody, a professor of past disaster science, who I said, what do you think is going to happen with, you know, from your knowledge of the past, what's going to happen now? And he just said, it has to be, it's the unpredicted catastrophe is what happens with this melting ice thing, because it makes all kinds of unexpected things happen. So that was that part.
Thank you.
Could I ask a question? On a more personal level, you said you were very involved in looking at things on a very minute scale.
Mm-hmm.
As an author now, do you find your horizons are, do you open up, or are you just, do you get very caught up in concentrating on one particular thing?
You mean one subject?
Yeah,
or
one subject at a time, you know, like, is your sort of...
Well, I hope I'm a bit wider. I still look at things on a beach with a downward bend, as it were, and with this, I've really enjoyed doing this book, and I found it so that it's widened up all kinds of thoughts of what I might do next.
Uh-huh.
It's broadened my thinking in some way, and the fact that you can take on something so difficult and make it understandable to yourself.
Yeah.
I did have it that with every chapter I'd sent it off to a paleontologist, a relevant paleontologist, and they'd write back and say, it's a million, not 500. But no, it's opened
up. So it's
given
you more confidence. It's opened up other things.
Confidence again, but it's given me a sense of it's. It was an interesting, it was a lovely process to think that you could take these difficult things and make them for myself primarily understandable, and then say, well, it can be explained.
What about the experts? I mean, that you have opened up the subject, perhaps, for other people's interest. How have they responded to that opportunity?
I had a wonderful review in the Archaeological Journal saying, why don't we make it as understandable as this? It's very nice, it's very complimentary, lovely review. Saying, gosh, this is Professor so-and-so and so-and-so, but we understand it in this book.
Mm.
So that was lovely. I've lost your question.
Yes, you've answered it.
I think that they. What amazed me was that I never came across a pompous paleontologist.
Right.
I thought they would say, you know, oh, it's so silly, you can't come with me on this something like that. But they were all very, very people who have an obsession, particularly when it's so incommunicable, that then means that they're very glad that somebody has enough knowledge to have a bit of a talk. I went to see the man who is in charge of the entire prehistory department of the British Museum, who is in this sort of extraordinary building of just locked doors and cupboards and things like that. And he was like a Zen Buddhist. He was, you know, he'd sort of, how to explain it. And I said, will you show me what you find most important in the collection? And he went into one of these stacks and he brought out a 400,000-year-old Neanderthal hand axe, but the point about it was that it had been choked, the stone was beautiful, but it was a sort of three stripes of colour with a little black thing like a little eclipse moon. And he sort of held it out like this and said, you know, this is the Neanderthals are where the secret lies of what is so extraordinary about the human being. Look. And that was very, the kind of meetings have been very interesting. People being so generous.
And people being quite quiet as well. They're quite calm and quiet people. Yes. Why do you think that is?
Well, they spend all their time with nothing written. And I met somebody who was a specialist in Neanderthal canine teeth. And you think, well, that's a life's achievement. That's what I've studied all my life. You know, and that's so that they're all busy with these tiny, tiny things of the one on the Seven Esters, you know, with a pair of tweezers taking out something and saying, oh, this is charcoal from a fire, and this is that kind of thing. Or the one at somebody on Gibraltar, this cave in Gibraltar, where wonderful cave, or Gorham's cave, where human beings had had a home for over 100,000 years without changing anything. The same rubbish place, the same place to sleep, the same everything, because it was fine, it worked well. And you had things like a sandbank at the front, where a group of Neanderthals had had a meal. They'd eaten some limpets and cooked some antelope and had a fire and made some flints to do the cutting up. And in time, that picnic had turned to stone because it was so much time since, you know, and keep kind of this, you know, look, this is a Neanderthal picnic. Isn't it, you know, and then what else do you say?
Yes.
So it's very interesting.
Any other questions? Yes.
Has it made you look at Suffolk itself differently? Mm. I mean, I walk along Bordsey and you see very visibly the effect of erosion, which in part is time-related.
Yes.
And I find that quite...
Bordsey is that wonderful, that's the bit where there's that's where the aerosene is, it's London clay. That's fantastic there, yes. It does make me see it differently. And with great respect, because sometimes the areas are so blank and sort of empty, and yet they have all this story.
Always moving.
It's moving stuff, and that bit of Bordsey is where you have stuff from the Eocene, which is whatever it is a million years ago. It's mangrove swamps and crocodile teeth. And
oh, gosh.
It's ridiculous.
Look
harder. I better look harder.
Yes, absolutely. And these fossilised little bits of wood that have been ionised that have turned to metal.
Okay.
It's crazy. And that's next to the fences of the First and Second World War.
Exactly that. Mm-hmm.
So then there's some kind of relativity that comes in and you think, whoa.
Yes. Thank you.
And how much travel did you do for the book? I mean, you mentioned the Severn Estuary and
I did a lot up and down the Suffolk and Norfolk coast. And then I went to Denmark and did a radio thing, which actually hasn't worked out because Tim Dee, who's the writer, then had to retire from the BBC, but I did a radio thing with him on going to Tollemand. I went to Gibraltar and to the Severn Estuary, and where else? In Holland, of course, going quite a lot to Holland. And I went out in a boat on the North Sea with a fisherman to fish for bones.
Did you find it?
Yes, they got a lot, but I thought we were going to go right out, but actually it was with a lot of white-haired, like myself, paleontologist, so I realised he couldn't say, let's go out, you know, and then they'd all fall in and it would be a disaster. But they did do with it, you scoop at the bottom and then it comes up and they go clonk on, you know, instead of having fish, they had the inner ear of whale, of a very old whales he found, which was beautiful, and a bit of manatee rib. Because it's that thing that same sea has had all these different times of hot and cold and shallow and deep, and you get it scooped up. So I did that, and I went to several places in Holland too.
So I haven't read the book, but where exactly did this huge country join?
Well, it goes, you start right up above Yorkshire, and you go across to Sweden. There's maps at the different...
There is a map.
Yeah, there's several maps. But then it goes down,
the
middle bit of the Doggerland time is when the Rhine and the Thames and the Meuse are still one river that go out of the Channel River, and then only with the rising of the waters that breaks through at the Dover, the cliffs, the White Cliffs, are separated from Normandy to England because of the rising water levels, and more water has come down the rivers. So it's that whole stretch from east and the south to the, you know, the whole eastern coast of England joining over. And when I did the book, started the book and got the sort of publisher to say they'd do it, there was no talk of that thing called Brexit. And then now they, you know, suddenly you think, when people say we are an island nation. Not necessarily so.
And drain the North Sea.
Yes, and that will, that'll solve the problem. an invisible border, a muddy border.
But it is quite an unusual book in how it's put together and the concept. And you say, talking to your publishers about getting them to get behind it. So was that a difficult decision for them? How did you convince them to go with you on this book?
I have this very nice editor who I've been at Cape, who I've been with for 28 years. The first time I met him, he came down the steps and he said, "Hello, I've just had twins." and I've known him ever since. And he's very, very supportive. And he kind of gives me a free rein. So he says, "Let's do it." He then has to present it to his sort of money boys. And he says, "Could you just write a bit more about that bit? Because I don't think I'm going to get it through." And then he gets it through. So we'll see. But he's been wonderful.
And what are your plans for the next book? What's
I can't say. I've done a very nice thing which I hope to work out, which is completely mad, which is the I went to that Picasso exhibition, the 1932 exhibition, and I wrote a series of poems in the voice of Marie Therese of Picasso's young mistress. Which a friend is it, this nice Jeff Fisher is illustrating. And it's going to be a radio thing. So that I've done. But the other thing is a big project which I can't begin to try and say.
Oh, okay.
But it's sort of scares me slightly.
Any other questions?
Not another question.
But what leads on from this then? Because obviously you're going to be talking about it. There's going to be you're on Start of the Week next week, did you say?
Yes, with two academics, and I'm terrified. Yeah. One is a specialist in demography. I had to look that up. And then the other one is on the Irish border divisions. And the demographer is completely, he says, the great miracle of human beings is that we reproduce so much and we have enough scientific inventiveness to go on doing really well, and I find that not my way of thinking at all, but we'll see.
Oh,
I'll try and hold my flag high.
Yes. And then there's going to be is it a day of
I thought it was going to be a day. It's actually just half a day, but nice friend Hugh Brody, who's a wonderful anthropologist who lived for a long time with the Inuit in the Arctic, and also with the British Columbian Indians, and also with the Bushmen of the Kalahari, and he's an extraordinary anthropologist. And he, in the middle section, I wanted to understand what these people were like who lived in Doggerland, and what it was like to live without history, with, you know, to live as hunter-gatherers, and how on earth you survive when you've got nothing but a few pebbles on the beach, and, you know, and how you do it. And he was very good in explaining that the hunter-gatherer way, you can go to the Netsinik Eskimos of the 1950s, or back to the Neanderthals, or over to the Bushmen, that actually you're going to have the same approach to life, not just to how to survive, but also what he calls porous boundaries, that you don't have the separation between you as a human being and the whole world around you, the animals or even the wind or whatever, that they're all, you're in a much more interactive state. And I found that very interesting. Because if you're moving around everywhere, you don't have that sense of conquering and owning, you don't have the sense of possession in the same way. So it makes for a different way of thinking. And I want to follow that up a bit in another book.
But he's going to be...
He'll be there talking. He'll show a film that he didn't make, but although he's made a lot of films, it was a film made in the 1950s of the Netsinik Eskimos fishing. There's a whole set of about 12 hours of film that they made in this time. And it's wonderfully funny. It's without subtitles and without commentary. You just watch these people being, and there's one where somebody goes hunting a seal and he lies on the ice and puts his feet in such a way that it looks like flippers, and he flaps his arm. And then he, if you pardon my French, said he farts every so often, because that's what feet seals do. And the two of them get closer, the seal is sort of moving towards him, and then he misses right at the end, he's going to try and kill it. But it's the most absurd thing of the man actually looking like a seal, and becoming a seal in order to catch the seal. And there's a lot of those kind of... And they're laughing all the time. I know that we talk about happy, simple people, but there is a kind of intimacy of laughter and of being together. There's one of a family sleeping, and the woman kind of emerges out of this sack, caribou sack, and the man emerges just to sort of shoulders. And then there's a pause, and then a little baby comes out from the very bottom of the sack. And it's something so wonderful. So that he'll show one of those songs, and he'll talk about hunter-gatherers.
And this is at Halesworth?
That's at the Cut.
The yes. Cut.
Yes.
In March.
14th of March, that is, yes.
There we are. Right. Anything else that we need to cover? I mean, you know, we've hit it all, haven't we, really? Oh, there we are, yes.
I really liked in Threads your talking to people, listening and watching and looking. And it sounds like this book has got a lot of that in it as well. And I wondered if it was one of your aims to get us all to look more closely and listen more carefully to the things that are around us. And so we can maybe value those more, I don't know. Or whether it's enough for you just to explain how you were doing it.
I don't think, and I'm not a kind of educational person in that way, but I think that what I found so interesting, and which I think is to do with what you're saying, is how if somebody has the concentration of their interest in something, how that can be communicated by them in a way that is very impressive, and that away from, you know, having to write it down or having to explain it, but just that sort of interaction of somebody doing something or knowing something, and that I find that important, and I find it very interesting to put that into. When I talk to people, I don't record them, but I have a pencil and just make notes as fast as I can, and I type that before my writing becomes completely illegible. And they kind of come alive again in my thoughts when I'm writing it up in a way that's. And I find great respect for people in that. I really like talking to people, apparently.
I think that comes across in the writing.
Yeah, it is. I've done it in other places, but somehow it amazed me that it was possible in England. I always thought of England as being unclothed as an island nation. But how people, if they've got something that they do, how open they are to, you know.
You just have to find them.
Yes, yes. Or you have your own interest. I mean, if you're an embroiderer, you find an embroider, you know, you whatever it can be that you can. I have nothing else to do. It's what I do. It is very, very. I mean, I was amazed with this, at these very professorial types, how open they were, and how they all talked about childhood, about how when they'd first come across things, like me with the rock pools, they'd come across something which had made them, and they all loved their job. They were all very kind of, you know, but incoherent about it, but loving it.
Speaking of threads, we don't give credit to the fact that people learning how to thread a needle, how to make a needle and thread it, and sew two pieces of skin together, how it transformed man's capacity to penetrate so far north,
even at the end of the Ice Age. Absolutely. This is the Neanderthals.
Neanderthals first and then modern man.
Absolutely. And that was so nice in doing the sort of study, if that's the word, of the Metsilic, of the Eskimos. In the 50s, they were still going through all these processes of how you get the skin ready, and you chew this, and you rub this in your thigh, and you wrap yourself up in the fur and sleep with it because that softens that bit, you know. But this extraordinary process to make yourself this bare forked creature that we are, to make ourselves able to withstand the elements. And in fact, the footsteps up at Haysborough, which were 900,000 years ago, the fossilised footsteps there have been making people rethink whether even then people were having, because how could they have stayed there all through the years with children as well? So it couldn't have been just a migration in the summer. So does that mean then that they had clothes, they were making cloaks and they had your needle and thread even then? Or did something, you know, it's exactly that the British Museum man would say. He'd say this combination, when you combine a stone with a handle, for instance, or sinew with glue, that then it's huge, great leaps of this. Yes. Yes. Bigger than ours, the Neanderthals. Mm-hmm.
But you had a fossil in your
pocket. I've got a fossil in my pocket. I've got two. I mean, they're just bits, but this one is the one that my grandmother gave me when I was a child. And she said, there you are, it's the fossilised paw of a tiger. And so for years I carried it around thinking I have the fossilised paw of a tiger. And then when I was starting this, somebody said, of course it's not, it's a mammoth tooth. So that's that one. And this is now, this is just a bit of, you can look at it, this is just a bit of bone from Kopai. But what I find so interesting with all bone, I found a huge bit the other day of a hip bone, but is that this energy of the honeycomb of the inside bone where the lymph goes, blood and lymph, is so energetic even now when you look at it. I find that such a nice thing. And the other side is so beautiful of that bit, just like, you know, like, I don't know what bit of a body I presume. It could also be a sea mammal, it could be a whale or something. And that's a bit of tooth of a mammal, because they have these little sliced tooth. But this kind of thing I find so beautiful to look at. Mm-hmm. I find it as an object exquisite in a way, and that you look at that and you do see that it held life.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's amazing having somebody identify it for you as well and explain
what
it is.
Well, this one is just a bit of bone. I don't know what it is. But other ones, I did have one that I found a bone which was kind of walking out towards the sea when I saw it. It was going like this out towards, you know, about to disappear.
Thank you.
And I brought it back and I sent a photo to this Klaus Post. The first person I showed it to said, oh, it's obviously giant beaver from the Holocene. And then I sent it to Klaus Post and he said, measure it from this point to this point. If it's 9 centimetres, I've got a different idea. And I measured it and he said, it's a female walrus, 2 million. And they have this knowledge. But it's absurd. And then this bit of female walrus that was like a kind of cartoon character. Every time the wave came, it was sort of going nearer to the sea and then it would have been gone.
Yeah. Right, well, that's the end of our evening. Don't rush off. Do speak to Julia a little bit more. Get your book signed. I think you'll find it a very special thing indeed. Thank you so much for all that you've done to find out more about this subject and to relate it to us, because it is a very beautiful book. There are just so many amazing things in it. Lots of information, but lots of meetings with individuals who are fascinating. And it's a book I know that I'm going to turn to again and again, because you just can't get enough.
When I started it, I had that wonderful quote from Shakespeare at the beginning, which is in it, which held me at the beginning, which is, a great while ago the world began with hey ho, the wind and the rain. And I thought that will focus me to kind of keep me going.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you all very much.